Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Losses Above Replacement, the greatest baseball podcast to grace your ears. I'm today's host, Matthias Altman-Kurosaki, and with me, as always, we have my amazing co-hosts, Alex Clark and Ryan Slash Potts. Gentlemen, first things first, as we begin every episode, how are we doing on this fine Monday evening?
It's getting colder. I'm doing okay, but it's getting colder over here. Like, I got out of work, and I could see my breath outside for one of the first times this year. But you know, honestly, it's been okay. Like, last weekend had a little bit of fun, got to do a surprise 30th birthday for a good friend of mine, so happy birthday, Sarah. But no, other than that, just been kind of getting through the days, you know, getting closer to holiday season.
Hello, it's still shorts and t-shirt weather where I am. That's everywhere in the world,
man, a man could dream.
Bro, I wear shorts and a t-shirt as often as humanly possible. I have to wear like khakis to work every day. So it's like, oh, but
I don't wear shorts if I can help it. I like wearing jeans.
Bro, shorts, the way to go. Absolutely elite stuff. I don't want to talk about football ever again. Although I will say this is official. If the Ravens beat the Bengals Thursday night, I will shave off all of my facial hair. I haven't done that.
I'll hold that to you.
Yeah, yep, I will hold that to myself as well.
It's now recorded.
I have not done that since December 31st, 2017, which ironically was after the Bengals beat the Ravens. I was there for that. I wanted to off myself.
If I'm not mistaken, that was the day Browns secured their 0-16 season.
Yes, Corey Coleman. Shout out to Corey Coleman, Baylor legend. But yes, that's – I know this is a baseball podcast, not a football podcast, but I'm so confident in the downfall of my rat birds that I will be risking my facial hair. So, and $200.
Yeah, I mean, the NFL season this year has been unique, let's say, for my team. I think it's ridiculous, honestly. I can't tell if this team's terrible or not terrible. I'll tell you that much.
Are they good?
Yeah, exactly. I'm with Alex though that it is getting colder, and I'm not really a fan of that. I'm definitely a warm weather person. I say that knowing I've lived in the Northeast my entire life. That's how things are going here.
I do have a question.
Yeah. What?
If we had like LAR headquarters, where would that be in the country?
Seattle.
somewhere where it's warm, in my opinion.
Seattle. I think so too. I think it also has to be within decent proximity to like an MLB team.
All of us.
Yes, it's Seattle.
Yeah.
Okay. Or an MLB team. All of us, I think that we can. I'm okay with moving.
Same.
Yeah, I need to keep my job for right now.
Okay.
That's the other thing. Yeah.
Okay. Based in Seattle would be interesting. I would have to wake up at 6 a.m. for London games. I don't know how I feel about that, but. We can vibe with it. So a future LAR headquarters near T-Mobile Park.
T-Mobile Park, that'd
be awesome, yeah. To be fair, like, you know, DVR is also a thing. So you won't have
is
to wait
though?
Up for it.
I
yeah,
mean,
that's how I watched the Colts and Pats game, unfortunately.
I mean, yes.
I get it. I don't know the last
that?
Time I... I don't know the last time I DVR'd something, though. That's the thing.
But I had to watch my boy Gardner Minshew, though.
Okay,
that's fair.
Fair enough.
Yeah, come on. I don't get to watch the Colts play very much here in Seattle, so I'm like, all right, you know what? I have this opportunity. We're taking it. And I was not waking up at 5:30 in the morning to watch a 6 a.m. game.
Fair enough.
But I will say this, though, with the cold weather, it's funny because I deal with it so much better than a lot of people do. Like, I wore a football jersey. I wore a t-shirt and a football jersey to work today, and the guy next to me was in two winter coats. Two winter coats.
Yeah. When I was in Colorado this summer, it got into the mid-60s, and I got pretty cold. And my boss later told me that for a northerner, I do not hold up well in the cold. And I was basically thinking, well, when it's mid-60s in late July, yeah, I'm pretty cold, actually.
I think the irony here is that I'm from the South, but like I feel most at home in Michigan. I'm the kind to wear shorts when it's 20 degrees outside, like that aforementioned Ravens Bengals game. I wore shorts to that. It was in the teens when the game ended.
Yeah, that's then again, I did grad school in Syracuse, New York, where it's freezing cold And there's snow on the ground from about November 1st on, I'm pretty sure. So anyways, back to baseball. We are in a season. Yes, the baseball season is over. It kind of flew by, in my opinion. But so far, we've gotten let's start with talking about the Gold Gloves and the Silver Sluggers that were announced last week. Starting out with the Gold Gloves in the American League, the winners were let's go by position, actually. So catcher Jonah Heim won the AL, Gabriel Moreno in the NL. Nathaniel Lowe won at first base in the AL, Christian Walker in the National League. Andrés Giménez, are also the Platinum Glove winner, won at second base in the AL, Nico Horner in the National League. Matt Chapman, third base in the American League. Key Brian Hayes gets his the first of many, in my opinion, at third base in the National League. At shortstop, Anthony Volpe and Dansby Swanson. Left field, Stephen Kwan and Ian Happ. Center field, Kevin Kiermaier and Brenton Doyle, the National League Platinum Glove winner, if I'm not mistaken. And then in right field, Adolis Garcia and Fernando Tatis Jr. Utility winners were Mauricio Dubon and Ha-Seong Kim. And the pitchers were Jose Berrios and Zach Wheeler. Now, we all had our own ballots that we filled out, and Splash posted them earlier tonight as of this recording. Gentlemen, who do you think was snubbed here? It's kind of tough. Like, personally, it took me a while to comprehend the Gold Glove award, but who do you think should have been a winner?
I mean, it just feels weird even going for this at all, just because of, like, yeah, we've talked about it ad nauseum on podcast that we don't really value the Golden Glove much, just because it feels like the wrong players get on it every year. I will say, just like, this isn't a snub. I'm just happy that, and I know Splash will talk about this too, that Key Brian Hayes finally got his Gold Glove that he so rightly deserved. I'm looking at the list here, and one that still jumps out to me that I feel like he should be on there somewhere, the list. That's Dalton Varsho. Like, Varsho is one that I think definitely could have made this list in a few different ways. The problem with him is that we've seen him do it at a number of different positions. So it's about, okay, where are you going to put him? Are you going to put him in utility? Are you going to put him in outfield? I mean, heck, you even tried the infield if you really wanted to, but don't.
At this point, he's a left fielder full time, though.
Yeah. That's the thing is that, like, Ian Happ was good. Was like, and, you know, sorry, Stephen Kwan was good, but was he that good? Was he above Varsho?
He was good, yes.
I don't know about that. That's the issue to me. I've been through this. You know, I have the spreadsheet with my 120 years of historical Gold Glove data that I've, like, made. And there's so many years that you'll have a guy, Brian Jordan is my example that I go to, go Braves, who split time between center field and right field. And he was elite in center, elite in right. But at the time, there was no utility position. So he wasn't going to win the Gold Glove for center field. He wasn't going to win the Gold Glove for right field. But he's, like, second in both. So he kind of gets snubbed there. And Varsho was very much the same. He led all of Major League Baseball in defensive runs saved. He was top three in the American League in a fielding run value, according to Baseball Savant. And he doesn't win in left field over Stephen Kwan. That's all right, I guess. Kwan was excellent. He was on par with Varsho in a lot of ways. But Varsho was also elite in center. He tied Kevin Kiermaier for center field defensive run save, despite playing half the games in center.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Kiermaier was unanimous for us. He won the actual Gold Glove. Like, no qualms there. But, you know, Varsho is elite in left, elite in center, and he gets left out. He won our Platinum Glove. Two of the three of us picked him to win our Platinum Glove. And he was our pick in left field. He could have won in center as well. So, you know, I think Varsho was missing from the real ballot. And I was in a debate, I guess, with a Guardians fan who thought Andrés Giménez should be Platinum Glove. That's fine. But Varsho was definitely in that conversation. And I'm glad we have some overlap here from our rankings, our picks to the real ones. We had Giménez made both, Chapman made both, Volpe made both, Kiermaier, Adolis Garcia made both, Dubon made both, Walker, Horner, Hayes, Happ, Doyle, Tatis, and Ha-Seong Kim in the National League. So there was some overlap, but there were some head-scratcher picks, in my opinion.
So one thing that I'm wondering is, so what really defines as a utility man, though? That's my question, because, like, it's this is a, that's the tough part with Varsho, is that I think he – it would have been weird for him to win center field. While he's excellent in center field, it's that, like you said, he played half as many games as Kiermaier did at that position, and he was fantastic in left field, too. But, like, because with Gold Gloves, unlike Silver Sluggers, these are by position. If it was just general outfield, he wins easily. 29 defensive runs saved.
I think it should have been by general outfield.
That's the thing. It was for a long time. They changed the rule, I think, in 2010. I believe it was in 2010. So, like, Ichiro winning Gold Gloves and right, those were just generic outfield Gold Gloves, or all of Andrew Jones's. So you'd have some years that it would be three center fielders. And I think that's disingenuous. Like, that to me, that's the only issue, that you are comparing left fielders to center fielders and right fielders. And, like, with all due respect, like, Brett Gardner, Roberto Clemente, and Andrew Jones or Willie Mays, whoever you think is the greatest defensive center fielder, they are not, like, Brett Gardner is not the same caliber. And Brett Gardner, according to Defensive War, is the best defensive left fielder ever. We can have that discussion another time. Yes. So
interesting.
Yeah. So we can have that conversation, but comparing, like, the Alex Gordons of the world, if you're comparing Alex Gordon to Lorenzo Cain, like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, no, because that's, I guess for Gold Gloves, it makes a little more sense to separate them by positions. Cause, like you said, like, three center fielders winning it, it doesn't quite make sense. Maybe I'm wondering, cause, like, now we have this utility category. Maybe we just put one for, like, general overall outfield. Like, cause it's a tough thing, is that if you play left and center field, are you really a utility man? No,
yeah, you're you're not. Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like Dubon could play center field. He could play shortstop, second base. You know, Ha-Seong Kim could play three of the four infield positions. We've never seen him play first, but he's very good at all three, so I get him winning. And I understand Dubon winning. It's just, it's tough because in this situation, Varsho kind of falls through the cracks. And it's unfortunate because he's very good.
Yeah, this could have been one of the cases that you have a Platinum Glove winner that doesn't win a Gold Glove. It's, I think in 2012, Mike Trout won a, like, Major League Defensive Player of the Year award, essentially, from Wilson, but he didn't get a Gold Glove, which not quite the same because he was primary center fielder. But you can have this situation.
Adam Jones won over it, yeah.
You can have this situation that the best defensive player in baseball, arguably, in Varsho. I think that's a fair argument you can make, but he wasn't the best at one position. He was just great everywhere, kind of like Ha-Seong Kim in the National League, but at least Kim was recognized as a utility piece, that he's comparable to Horner, comparable to Swanson or Lindor at second and short, but he's going to play a lot more second this year. But he was, you know, played some third, played some short, and combined everything together, he was as valuable of a defensive player as anyone in baseball. But you have to, like, split the production up over three positions.
Yeah, and that's kind of what comes to me when I look at utility overall, is that I see a utility guy as someone that can play infield and outfield. And maybe that's just a me thing here, but I think that if you're a utility guy, you are plugged in where you need to be. And that's where I think, that's why I like the idea of having the utility Gold Glove. Because at that point, you want to have these kind of people that can do infield, outfield play. But you're right. Like, it doesn't make sense for a guy like Varsho to be considered for utility if you're only playing the outfield, or if you're only playing, you know, the infield. Like, I can understand a little bit more on the infield because I think each individual infield position. So, okay, follow with me for a second. I personally think that each individual infield position is a lot more specialized than each individual outfield position. I think that the center fielder is definitely the most, like, important of them, for defensively wise speaking, at least. But, like, you can't try to put a first baseman at shortstop half the time. Half the time, you can't put a second baseman over at third. It doesn't, it's a lot more specialized, whereas I feel like a lot of times with outfielders, you can put a left fielder in right and it could still at least work. Like, I'm not going to say it's going to be great, but it's going to work.
Yeah, I'm following.
Yeah, I'm following.
Like, the even the defensive, like, matrix they use for, like, war purposes, you have different for third, second, short. All of those are different. While the outfields left and right are the same, and there's a little bit of a drop from center field. So, like, I agree, it's not always a perfect thing. This is like the Juan Soto question, the Ronald Acuna question, guys that have like switched from left to right or vice versa. But kind of, if you're playing at short, you can realistically play anywhere. Like, look at Fernando Tatis, who was the real Platinum Glove winner, and I deserving selection, even though we didn't pick him.
Yeah.
Like, he's a shortstop that
moves. That's right,
If you have a right fielder move to shortstop, probably not going to be great.
So at the same time, like, kind of think about this a little bit oddly, right? The Platinum Glove is supposed to go to the best defensive player in the league, right? Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
So how weird would it be in this kind of weird scenario where a player like Dalton Varsha, and I'm not saying that he should have won on this, just theoretically, that means this is possible, that a player cannot win a Gold Glove, but could win a Platinum Glove.
Yep.
That a player like, and I think honestly that
I can see that
that could happen with Varsho. And I think that would be honestly kind of awesome to see a player that everyone just kind of recognizes as being the best in the league, the best in the game. But you can't put him as a Gold Glove for any position because they don't fit into any one position. Or like in Varsho's case, they play different outfield positions and he plays them both at an exceptionally high level. That would be really interesting to see.
We kind of see this with Ohtani, right? Because he's not the best pitcher and sometimes isn't the best DH, right? Maybe you take Yordan Alvarez or Bryce Harper or whomever, and there's some pitchers you take over him, but he's the best player in baseball just because he does both, right?
Exactly. Yes. Like that's goes back to my argument why I hate the name of the most valuable player for the same kind of purpose. On that is that are there better pitchers than Ohtani? Yes. Are there better hitters than Ohtani? Yes. Is there a better player and a more valuable player than Ohtani? No.
I mean, personally, I would argue Davis Schneider is better, but that's just me.
I mean, fair.
Or Brett Beatty, one of the two.
I don't know. I mean, Jared Kelenic is the best player in baseball. I don't know what to tell you guys.
I don't know about that one.
I don't know about that one.
Give me Guillermo Heredia.
Guillermo Heredia. No, Mets legend. Mariners, Mets, and Braves legend.
Yes. And Braves, yeah.
What do you think of Guillermo Heredia on the show to see which team he liked best?
probably the Braves because he won a ring with them.
This is true. This is a good point.
Yeah, I mean, gold gloves, I mean, that's the thing. It's, for me, like, I mean, I'm going to reference the Immaculate Grid here, but like whenever Gold Glove is a category, it just completely messes with my brain because there's so many great defenders who like haven't won a Gold Glove. Yeah. I mean, Kevin Pillar never won a Gold Glove. Or
he did get MVP votes though.
I know he did. And I mean, look, as a Mets fan, I resent saying this guy's name, but Chase Utley never won a Gold Glove at second base, which is insane to think about because he was, I mean, he had the year, I believe he had like close to 30 defensive runs saved. So let's move over to the Silver Sluggers and just to read them off. In the American League, it was Adley Rutschman at catcher, Yandy Diaz at first, Marcus Semien at second, Rafael Devers at third, shortstop was Corey Seager, outfield was Luis Robert, Julio Rodriguez, and Kyle Tucker, DH was Shohei Ohtani, and utility was Gunnar Henderson. And in the National League, it was William Contreras at catcher, Matt Olson at first, Ozzy Albies at second, Austin Riley at third, Francisco Lindor at short, Ronald Acuna, Mookie Betts, and Juan Soto in the outfield, Bryce Harper at DH, and Cody Bellinger at utilities. So any snubs on this? I believe these are pretty similar to what we had. Yes, Alex.
So there's one big sub before Splash gets to say anything on this. Cal Raleigh deserves it. I don't care what anyone says. I don't care what any other metrics say. Cal Raleigh is the best catcher in baseball. He deserved that Silver Slugger.
You know, okay, I'm good.
Now in the realm of the living, in the realm of like the consequential, okay, we had in total 7 disagreements. 2 of them came in utility spots, which we duplicated bets and we gave Paredes the nod over Henderson. Those are whatever. It depends on who's the finalist for those awards and who's even considered for those. But our difference is we had Rally instead of Adley. We had Jose Ramirez instead of Rafael Devers. We had obviously the utility positions I mentioned. We had Freeman instead of Olson. We had a rise instead of Albies. Some Braves erasure there. But then we gave the Braves one more for Marcelo Zuna over Bryce Harper.
Hang on. I'm stupid. Arraez won at second base in the National League. I was gonna say
that was definitely not on my radar because I would have taken even Ketel Marte over Ozzie, but
I think I did vote for Ketel for me personally.
Yes, so. You did.
I voted for.
Oh no! You had Betts as your second baseman, Marte as your utility spot. Okay,
right.
I will say, third base in the AL was tough. Like you have five dudes. It felt like with the same stats. Like you have Brady's, you have Ramirez, you have Devers, you have Henderson. If you want to count him at third,
they're all very similar. Well. Yeah,
they're all like equivalent. They're all in that range of 125 OPS plus to 135 OPS plus, and you're debating. Oh, well, Isak Paredes didn't walk as much as Jose Ramirez, but he had more total base. It's like weird stuff like that. So I'm okay with those picks in the American League. I will say the National League, the Freeman Olson one that we disagreed with.
That was a tough one. It was a toss up for me.
Because you have two of the top five hitters in baseball this year. Like agreed. Like, with all due respect to Corey Seager, because on a rate basis, he was better. But the volume of production that Freeman and Olson had is like 3 and 4 or 4 and 5 in baseball. You have Otani up there. You have Betts up there. You have Acuna up there. And they're competing for one spot. I picked Olson for my ballot. I think the volume was there. But I did have Freeman higher my MVP ballot. Like just defensive stuff, the base running stuff. So if you're counting base running and Silver Slugger Award, I don't know. But then okay, I guess you can go Freeman. But I will say I also picked Ozuna as a DH, 40 home runs, 100 RBI. I know that's like the volume there to me was a little bit more impressive than Harper being better on a rate basis. But I don't mind Harper winning, I guess.
Yeah. So here's the thing, and I'm realizing that like my logic kind of contradicted itself with my selections because I picked Cal Raleigh at catcher in the American League. And this is just the way I've always thought for some reason, like before Cal Raleigh, I was a huge fan of Mike Zunino. I don't know why. I think it's because he was a catcher with huge raw power who was a pretty good defender behind the plate. I don't know what it was. Like I was, you know, and I was also a big fan of Hunter Renfroe, similar type player in the outfield, Mike Napoli before that, although Napoli wasn't as great defensively. But I don't know, something about a catcher who could hit 30 homers appeals to me. So that's why I picked Raleigh in the American League.
So the realm of the living here, right, Spaj? Yeah, two of the people on the show picked him. So
where was I? But over in the National League at first base, I picked Freeman. I thought, I mean, something, I mean, 59 doubles. I understand 50. That's the thing. 54 homers is a ridiculous season. I thought Olson for a while almost had a shot to catch Acuna in the MVP race, which we'll get to in a little bit. But like, I went with Freeman because, I mean, he had that stretch where he would like, you couldn't get him out really. But 29 homers, 59 doubles, that's a season. I mean, we haven't seen a guy hit 60 doubles in a long time, and he almost got it. So, yeah, I went with Freeman there. I mean, I think that was basically – oh, and I had gone with Harper. Harper down the stretch was very tough to get out. I think, if he stayed healthy for a full season, you're probably looking at like a 35, maybe 40-homer season. That's the thing. He got off to a slow start. And also, by the way, he's going to be in the first base conversation going forward because
What do you guys think about Harper being a first base?
I know that's the thing is that it was with Rob Thompson and Dave Dombrowski saying he's going to play first base. That's going to be interesting because now going forward, we'll have Olson, Freeman and Harper in this conversation, which is insane to think about. It's funny because Bryce Harper was actually a catcher. Throughout like through JUCO and everything, and then he became an outfielder after he got drafted. So I do remember back when I first started when I was toying with franchise mode and MLB The Show, and Bryce Harper had catcher as a secondary. that was back in MLB 12 The Show. If you played back then, you may remember that.
SDS, yeah. give us a Harper card with catcher secondary, you cowards. Oh come on, God. Let's see that.
That would break the game.
It would be disgusting.
Anyway, so also today, Rookie of the Year was announced. Both winners were unanimous. This is the fifth time it has happened. Gunnar Henderson in the American League, Corbin Carroll in the National League. I just want to pat myself on the back right here. Those were my preseason picks. Bow down, everybody.
Good on you. Good on you.
So, I mean, give me your thoughts on this race, because I feel like beyond the winners, there was actually a lot of talent in this year's class. I mean, in the American League, you had Tanner Bibee coming second, who I feel like we did not give him enough love throughout the season. And Tristan Casas, who came in third, he had a terrible month of April, rebounded really well. And then nationally, you had guys like Kodai Senga, you know, James Outman. I feel like he had a great month of April, and then everyone sort of stopped talking about him. I know he did struggle a little bit, but you had Outman, you had Matt McClain, who was my third place pick, Spencer Steer, Yuri Perez. Like, what were your guys' thoughts overall in this rookie class? Because I was amazed at the depth from this year's voting.
You know, I think if you look at this year's voting and you take guys that didn't receive votes in the AL and NL, you could have some really great rookies.
Yeah, Francisco Alvarez didn't get any votes.
Yeah, no votes for Alvarez, no votes for Yennier Diaz in the American League.
I think I saw Diaz's name on the ballot.
I don't believe so. I think Volpe got a vote, but Yennier Diaz did not. That was one of the comments below.
Edward Julian, I know, got that. Two.
But you have like the guys out in Oakland, and this is an exceptional
Ruiz
rookie
didn't
class.
Get any. Yeah,
yeah. So no votes for Geloff or Estuary Ruiz. The Ruiz one's a little bit of a throwback pick, I guess. But even in the National League, not much love for Patrick Bailey, who is exceptional defensively and solid enough at the plate. And it just felt like there was such a deep class that, yes, we have the two shining stars at the top. You have the future likely MVP winners in Carroll and Henderson, and they're head and shoulders above everyone else, really, with Josh Jung going down to injury. That kind of put any nails in coffins there. But I think this is a great spot for baseball. And next year, you're looking at another good class of rookies. You have Evan Carter out in Texas, who I think is probably the favorite right now, depending on
probably
where
right
Yamamoto
now.
Goes.
Yeah.
But
Jackson Holliday.
Exciting times.
Might be in the majors.
Exciting times.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, also, by the way, yeah, so Diaz finished fifth. He got one second place vote and three third place votes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's kind of fun to notice here, and kind of piggybacking off of what Splash said here a second ago, it's interesting to see that number one and number two in both the American League and National League were both a good hitter and a good pitcher too. Tanner Beebe for the Guardians, and then Gunnar Henderson winning it for Baltimore, and then the National League, Corbin Carroll and Kodai Senga. Like, it was kind of sad because we were talking about this, I believe it was back in August, that there was a graphic that said, is there any intrigue left with the award races? And so far, there hasn't been. We've been able to pick so far when it comes to Rookie of the Year. Now, we were right on the nose. Like, it was unanimous for Corbin Carroll and for Gunnar Henderson. And you know what? Well-deserved to both of them. Both of those players made incredible strides this year. And I just want to make sure, especially, I want to give great note to Corbin Carroll, man. When he came in at the beginning of this year, there was a ton of hype around him, and he lived up to it. Like, everyone just said that, like, okay, well, if he's going to be good, they know that there's one constant, one thing that is an absolute definite, and that is his speed. He's going to have the speed, it's going to be great, but now can he get on base? Can he hit? Can he defend well enough? Well, guess what? He can do all of them and do all of them at an exceptionally high level. So, you know what? He was one that there was a ton, and I mean a ton, of expectations put on him, and he came through absolutely beautifully.
Yeah, and he's the first rookie to have 25 homers and 50 steals in a season. And also, I want to shout out the guy who came in fourth in the National League, which is Nolan Jones, who had a 2020 season. And yes, he did have a nearly 30% strikeout rate. But, you know, I want to point to his home road splits, because you know, he's on the Rockies, so everyone's gonna be like, oh my god, he's a Coors merchant. Let's look at it. He actually had a higher OPS on the road. He had a 935 OPS on the road and a 928 OPS at home. So I think Nolan Jones is a guy to look out for. He's almost, I don't know if I can quite say he's a five-tool guy with all the strikeouts, but he's got power, he's got speed. He's got a great throwing arm in the outfield. He's actually transitioned very nicely to being an outfielder. Mm-hmm. I remember coming up, I was expecting him to be a first or third baseman, and now he's going to be playing the outfield. And I think he's done a great job. So that's mm-hmm. the thing, is that Jones almost gets lost in the shuffle because he's stuck behind guys like Carroll and Senga and Outman. I mean, this thing is like Matt McClain got hurt late in the season. Maybe, I mean, there was a chance he could have been higher up in the voting, or Spencer Steer. He for a while had a strong chance. I mean, Alvarez, I know, was very up and down, which is probably why he didn't get a vote. But the fact that a rookie catcher who had 25 homers didn't get any votes, I think speaks volumes about mm-hmm. how good this National League class was.
And to add one more name even to that, Ellie De La Cruz got a third place vote, and he was the guy that, remember earlier in the season, with how well he was playing, there's a lot of people saying that if he continues even remotely on this pace, he would be not just a rookie of the year but an MVP candidate.
Yeah, like, I'm curious about De La Cruz because I think he's a very flashy player. Yes, 100%. But he also, like, he's a ton of holes in his game. Let's say he strikes out a lot, hits the ball on the ground a lot, but he's a fascinating player, and I'm very curious to see how he develops. Moving off the rookie of the year voting for a second, because manager of the year is the next up, and so I just, the thing I want to talk about here is just your thoughts on this award as a whole, because to me, I don't know how I feel about this award, because we were discussing this in our, you know, separate text chat that you know, we've seen this in the past where managers get this award and then immediately get fired, or they get fired before the voting even happens. And so I just am wondering, how much do you guys value this award? Because, like, the guy, I picked Torey Lovullo, but Torey Lovullo is not a finalist this year. I mean, Skip Schumacher, I think, probably wins the award in the National League. But how much do you guys value this award? Do you value it at all? I mean,
no. No.
Okay, I'm kind of on the same path here. Yes.
Yeah, this is a circumstantial one, similar to all Manager of the Year awards. I look at the NFL one as well, but this is a case of the process changes every year. That you'll have a manager that some years it's, oh, this team overachieved, right? They shot past what they were projected to win. Like Brandon Hyde with Baltimore, they were a 75 to 80 win team. Projected. Well, they win 100 games, they're their best team in the American League. Okay, that makes sense. Well, the National League, the guys that we had in our collective ballots, Skip Schumacher, Marlins overachieved, they made the playoffs. Torey Lovullo, they overachieved. The D-backs overachieved, they made the playoffs. Craig Counsell, the Brewers always overachieve. Like, is this just going to be the Craig Counsell Award? Brian Snitker, the Braves improved from a 101 win season, believe it or not. Rob Thompson, the Phillies improved off of making the World Series. David Bell in Cincinnati, they overshot expectations. So you have, like, all sorts of ways you look at this. And, like, last year's ballot was really weird when you have Dave Roberts,
Buck Showalter,
and Brian Snitker as your top three. And you're looking at those rosters and thinking anyone could guide these teams to 100 wins. And then this year you're flipping it around. It's like, well, we're going to have the Schumachers of the world are going to win it. Well, last year you gave it to, I forget who won it, probably Dave Roberts.
Showalter won it.
Ah, okay. So you give it to Buck Showalter, and the Mets had high expectations. And the Mets even, like, fell off a cliff, or quote unquote fell off a cliff, more like the Braves just chased them down.
Yeah, but I was going to say that.
Like, if you were in the end of September, and you're watching the Mets collapse. Sorry, Mac. You're watching the Mets collapse in Atlanta. You're saying, how is Buck Showalter even a good manager, let alone the best manager in the National League? And this is the problem with Manager of the Year, that with other awards, we know what we're doing. We have a logic, right? With this one, you can be a great manager and, like, a Craig Counsell and take an 80 to 85 win team and consistently make the playoffs with them, that's valuable. But we're also going to sometimes reward Dave Roberts taking a 100 win team. Oh, they win 111 games. Great. Right. Okay. That 11 win gap, which doesn't change anything standings wise, really. Well, that's more impressive than, say, I had AJ Hinch on my ballot, for example. He's expected to win like 65 games. And after April 7th, the Tigers were above 500. I think that's pretty valuable. You get a 500 ball club out of a team that was projected to finish worse than the Royals, and the Royals won 60 games. So it's just inconsistencies all over.
My problem when it comes to overall with the award is that I don't think a manager's worth should be based solely on wins and losses, because I think what's a little bit interesting as well, when you take a look at other awards versus this one, is that, like, let's say with a Silver Slugger, right? You have very finite offensive stats that we could draw from. We have, you know, batted ball rates. We have RBIs. We have home runs. We have OPS. We have all these things that we can use. With a manager, wins and losses is really all you have. I mean, you can have challenges, I guess, but that's just adding more arbitration to it. In my opinion, the best managers are the ones that overperform, or the ones that can work a ball club. And a lot of things that you're going to see from the best managers, you aren't going to see on a piece of paper. You're not going to see in a stat sheet. Those are the ones that are the players respect the manager. The players are willing to buy into a manager system, and are the manager's able to do so many more inside jobs than what any person could see. I think it would almost be interesting that for the manager of the year, instead of it being voted on by the analysts and all that, have the players do that one. I think the players have a much better
view. I can see that working, yeah.
Yeah, a much better view of how the managers actually work. And I do. You could just have it be like, you know, they're going to vote for their own team, their own manager.
I think that's not allowed to happen.
Yeah, but if you can just choose to not vote for another bit on that.
I mean, you have to kind of delineate as well between how much I'm going to use Craig Counsell as an example. Mm-hmm. How much of Milwaukee overachieving every year is strictly Craig Counsell, but how much of it is their pitching masterclass or their catching masterclass? That they like, is Craig Counsell, does he get credit for William Contreras going from a great offensive player and a horrible defender to a great offensive player and a great defensive player? Is he getting credit for having Devin Williams, right? Is having an asset like Devin Williams or having a great bullpen option? Oh, okay, just go to the great bullpen option. He's going to pull through 95% of the time, let's say. Okay, then you're going to look like a smart manager because you're putting in good players. But if you are the Texas Rangers and you're having to put in Aroldis Chapman because you're Chris Young can't build a bullpen properly, and you're like banking on Aroldis Chapman to get outs in the playoffs, is that a good manager decision or a bad manager decision? It's all like contextually based on how the general manager builds the team, how your other coaches are doing stuff. Is your third base coach good, right? Does Austin Riley, does Brian Snitker get credit for Austin Riley becoming a gold glove finalist? No, that should be Ron Washington. Right? New Angels manager, by the way, which I am very sad about.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It's tough there's so much that goes into manager that I think even the other players.
Yeah.
You have like that tangible, like Acuna had 40 home runs and stole 70 bases. Okay, great. Brian Snitker, most Braves fans thought he did pretty poorly this year and they thought the Braves could win more games. But you could make the argument, no Fried. Morton was all right. No Anderson, no Wright for half the season. Strider had an ERA closer to 4 half the time. And they still win 104 games. And they still have a good rotation.
And the other thing, in my opinion, is that I understand that all the ballots are turned in after the regular season. But this is the one award I think it should be voted on after the postseason. Because, I mean, this is the thing, is like Dave Roberts was a finalist last year. And I'm not, with all due respect to Dave Roberts, 111 wins is great, but they got bounced in the NLDS. And also, everyone expected them to be at least in the World Series last year. Like, it, in my opinion, like, Torey Lovullo, if this was voted on after the season, probably is manager of the year in the National League. Instead, he's not a finalist. So, and also, like I was saying earlier, I mean, I remember back in 2006 when Joe Girardi led the Marlins to a 78-84 win record and got fired before it was announced he won manager of the year. Meanwhile, Willie Randolph led the Mets to their first division title in 18 years, the first team not named the Braves to win the NL East since 1993, and he didn't win the award. Like, it's kind of ridiculous. And also, I mean, look, Buck Showalter wins manager of the year, and he gets fired the next year. Like, it's, I feel like it almost creates like a target on your back once you win manager of the year, because if you don't come through on expectations, you're probably going to get let go. So that's just my whole thing on manager of the year. Moving on real quick, because we're starting to run a little short on time, but there's one award we did have a disagreement on, which is the National League Cy Young. So I just want your guys' thoughts. I mean, Blake Snell is probably going to win. He led the majors in ERA, but how do you guys feel about giving the Cy Young to a man who averaged 5 walks per 9?
You know, I've kind of learned to accept it. And a lot, part of this comes from watching Nathan Eovaldi pitch in the World Series, that he walked guys, but sometimes it's almost like an intentional, unintentional walk. And you're playing the, not necessarily percentages, because in 99% of circumstances, walking a guy is a bad idea. But you are saying, I'm not going to let 1, 2, 3, or 4 beat me. I'm going to force number 5 to beat me. I'm going to force number 6 to beat me. I'm going to make it a little bit easier for defensively. I can say they have the data and says, okay, well, if we put the guy on first and we play our normal defensive alignment, or we can play an alignment that lets us have a force out at second or force out at third or force out at home, these little nuances over the course of a full season might not make a difference, maybe one run or two. But if you are narrowing that down under 200 innings for a guy like Blake Snell, or for one game for Eovaldi, that can be really big swings in production. And Snell caught a lot of really good production. He was great at leaving men on base. Part of that skill, part of that is luck. Part of that is having guys like Fernando Tatis, Manny Machado, Ha-Seong Kim, Xander Bogaerts is okay at short. Trent Grisham in center, and the disaster in left field in Juan Soto, but we're not going to talk about that. But I think Snell is deserving, and the walk numbers is partially inflated because Snell let them get that high. He's not going into every plate appearance saying, let me walk this guy. But there's some situations it might be better to walk a guy than it might be better to walk Bryce Harper and pitch to some other guy in the Phillies lineup. It might be better for parts of the year. Why should I pitch to Matt Olson, right? Let me pitch to Marcell Ozuna. Or why should I pitch to, I'll use a Braves example, why should I pitch to Orlando Arcia, a right-handed hitter, when Michael Harris can't hit the broadside of a barn against left-handed pitching half the time? So let me just walk Orlando Arcia, not give him anything to hit, pick around the edges, and then dominate Harris. I think that's pretty logical, and I think that's something that Snell did very well, but on the aggregate, it's going to look weird. He has a huge walk total. Yeah, but a lot of those were intentional walks to get easier matchups, to heighten the lefty-lefty stuff, because he was unbelievable against lefties. So if you're like top of the order right-handed batter, Snell might walk you, and it's intentional.
I personally feel that when it comes to like, because like I love Blake Snell personally, like I love the dude. He's a Seattle kid, so I gotta love him on that. Plus, what his style of pitching is always fun. The thing that I just don't like, I just don't like giving up that many free passes. I'm personally always gonna be of the belief that free passes are always going to be a bad thing, unless of course you're talking about, you know, like intentional free passes that are used to get a better situation, all that kind of stuff. But giving up a free pass means throwing more pitches, means you're getting out of the game earlier, and you're now working from the stretch a lot more, which has been shown to be a little bit less effective than pitching from the windup. But it's a necessary evil at that point. It's weird. I know I was going back and forth between a number of different people when it came to this, and Snell was definitely one of the ones I kept thinking, does he deserve it? Does he deserve to be in this discussion? Does he deserve to be number one for that? And I kept coming to the consensus of no, just because I felt like if you are good enough to where you can dominate when having great stuff, then you have great strikeout numbers. You're able to get through all the, you have great ERA at that point. The only thing that needs to be better is your control. Then get better control. Like, having stuff and having ability and having talent is something that is so much harder to teach than how to pinpoint a pitch a little bit better. Like, and I get, maybe that's a bit of opinion there, but like I like having flamethrowers. I like guys that can throw fast, that can dot a fastball, that can just blow it right past anybody. But at the same time, I also go back to guys like, you know, Greg Maddux, that when he got good, is like, we needed to get better. It wasn't, oh, I'm going to throw harder. It's, I'm going to locate better. And there was always the joke talking about players that, you know, can throw 100 miles an hour, and yet with him, he's going to throw an 89 mile per hour sinker, and you're not even going to swing at it.
I do, right on the corner. I believe Maddux is credited with saying this, but like the best way to pitch to Barry Bonds was to not pitch to him. Right. And I know no one in baseball is like Barry Bonds nowadays, mm-hmm. but sometimes that's your best option.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's better. Following,
yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like,
bro, are you facing Barry Bonds four times a game? Are you facing
there might
Barry
be,
Bonds?
There might actually, be situations yeah, you get that, like that difference that, you know, hitter four in the lineup versus hitter five in the lineup. Look at, sorry for the Mets slander, but there were some days when the Mets had a Bozo behind Pete Alonso. Why are you pitching to Pete Alonso? Why are you pitching to Pete Alonso? What's the point?
Well, that's why,
Jose Ramirez with Cleveland. He led the majors in intentional walks. Mm-hmm. No one after Judge scares you. And I think that's a way to get around some lineups. And sometimes the walks themselves, like, I know a lot of them didn't score, and I get that, and only like hit like 9 of his 92 walks or something score, something ludicrous like that. Yes, because it's situational. He's not trying to walk guys with no outs. He's not trying to walk Judge as the first batter of the inning. He's going to pitch to Judge, and he probably is going to get Judge out. That's just how baseball works. But if it's 2 outs in the inning and there's a guy on second, so it's like, okay, well, let me go get a ground ball or strike out the next guy who might be more prone to strike out, or might be particularly bad against left-handed pitching, or might be particularly bad against Snell's arsenal itself. And I think there's a lot more that went into it. I think if you asked Snell, if Snell tried to not walk people, he wouldn't walk people, or he wouldn't walk certainly as many people, but there's like a strategy to it. And as much as I agree with you, Alex, that I don't intentionally walk people when I play MLB Power Pros, unless I'm playing against like Sitch, I don't walk people, even if it's Albert Pujols or Andrew Jones or the best hitters in the game. I try not to walk people, but sometimes it's valuable. Sometimes I'd rather face So Taguchi than Albert Pujols.
No, and I'm following you. I follow you on that, but here's one thing that I disagree with on that, because I also, by the way, I do pitch to Sitch and I strike him out. But regardless, get good.
Please send me video evidence.
I've done it many times, and if I had the recording, I'm already doing it anyway.
He's gotten deep on you more times than that.
Disagree, but anyway. So here's one thing that I do want to say with this, and that. Because I agree with you 100% that if the situation applies for it, then yes, walk the person. Like, that makes 100% sense. Yeah, like, why not? But I'm looking at the stats for 2023 for Snell here, and there's one stat that jumps out to me. And it's not the walks, it's the intentional walks. You know what that number is on the season?
Should be very low, right? Yeah.
Zero.
But
there's a practicality because Snell has the kind of stuff that gets whiffs. So if it's 3-2 and he throws a ball in the dirt, what's the worst that's going to happen? The guy ends up on first base. Well, if he leaves it over the plate, a lot more damage can be done over the plate than a pitch that's off the plate. So yeah,
but if you're a major league pitcher, that's a decision.
Like, that is an active decision the Padres are making. He is making that he will be able to pitch out of it. He has a great defense behind him. So if the guy makes contact, so there's three options. He takes the pitch, walks to first base. Okay. Depending on the hitter, that's not a high likelihood. Option two, he swings and misses. Great. Depending on the hitter, that's a high likelihood. Option three, he's going to ground the ball into the dirt or pop it up, and someone on a very, very good defensive infield is going to catch it or throw it over the first. So there's a process. There's a method to the madness.
Oh, no, I completely agree with that. But at the same time, also, I think that if you were a major league pitcher and one of the best major league pitchers in the game, then you need to be able to, on a 3-2 pitch, right? And if you have that swing and miss stuff, that whiff kind of stuff, you're putting something that's at least close to the zone. You're putting stuff that is going to be that you're going to challenge the hitter, and you're not just going to put it over the middle of the plate. Even a 102 mile per hour fastball, when put over the middle of the plate, can still get launched out into the outfield. But if you have a good fastball, a good sinker, slider, anything like that, that is going to paint those edges, that is going to work with that, and then still get that whiff on it, that number goes down a lot. Goes down a lot. And if right now what it's showing is that that's not what's happening here. He had 99 walks on the season. That is, that's egregious.
I mean, yeah, so that's the thing, though, is that so he had a lot of walks, and yes, he averaged under six innings per start, but it's also that with men on base, his opponents only have a 528 OPS. With men in scoring position, they only had a 470 OPS. With the bases loaded, they went 1-for-15 against them. So he knew how to pitch out of these jams, and for that reason, for a while, Justin Steele was probably the front runner, but I think Snell did enough to separate himself from the rest of the pack. So that's just my final little bit on the NL Cy Young race. But
yeah. Here's one nugget I want to pull out. The OPS of the guys hitting third and fourth against Snell. Batting third, 774 OPS. That's like reasonable. A 402 on base percentage. That's very good. Batting fourth, slugged 450, OPS of 742. All right, right after that, playing the fifth guy in the lineup, 312 OPS. He allowed six hits in 73 at-bats against the number five hitter. Hmm. And then the number six hitter was 558, the number seven hitter was 588, the number eight hitter was 429, the number nine hitter was 413. So the top of the order, relative to Snell's overall production, was pretty good.
The average number three hitter
was a 105 OPS plus hitter against Snell. And Snell was one of the best pitchers in the game. That's bad. But then the number five hitter was the equivalent of a negative 11 OPS plus. That's like Jeff Mathis territory. That's like pitchers hitting territory. So he's making that active decision to say the average third hitter, the average four hitter is a much better hitter than the average five hitter. So he's going to take that shot. Sometimes it's going to work and sometimes it doesn't. And more often than not, it worked out for him this year.
I get that. But anyways, that'll sort of put a bow on our awards discussion. Let us know what you think at LAR_baseball. But now it is time for everyone's favorite segment, which is trivia. And today, Splash is doing that. So, Splash, take it away.
Boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, this is only tangentially related to baseball. I would like to give a shout out to my friend Cassie. She went to a Morgan Wallen concert the other day, and Morgan Wallen has a song called 98 Braves. So in the theme of Morgan Wallen's song about the Braves, I am going to ask you to name the baseball players referenced in these songs. I will give you the lyrics. So if you have no shot here, I'm sorry.
I'm so bad at music. Okay.
Okay. We'll see. Mac, please pick a number. One of you pick a number between 1 and 100.
44.
Okay.
45.
The number was 3. Mac, you may go first here.
That's close.
All right. Are you ready?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Fill in the blank from the epic rap battle between Marilyn Monroe and Cleopatra with the correct baseball player. Quote, you'll sleep with any ugly dude who says he likes it hot. Even blank blank took a swing in your batter's box.
I know this one.
Joe DiMaggio?
Joe DiMaggio is correct.
Yep. Let's go.
Okay, I've listened to all the ERBs way too much.
Yes. Okay, Alex.
All right.
Fill in the blank from Big Sean's song, All Your Fault. I walk off in New York like my name.
Babe Ruth?
No. Mac, do you have a guess?
Derek Jeter?
Yes, Derek Jeter is correct.
Oh, actually? Let's yes. go.
All right, Mac, back to you. Fill in the blank from Beyonce's Deja Vu from a line rapped by Jay-Z. I run the bases like...
What? I run the bases like... Barry Bonds, I don't know. I know that's the incorrect. Name of the song.
Ichiro.
That is incorrect. It is Juan Pierre.
Oh my god.
Wow, I can't believe I actually referenced Juan Pierre in a song. All right.
Okay, yeah, Alex.
Quick question. Yes. What are we playing to? Or what?
We'll play until one of you gets three strikes.
Okay, so I guess we each have a strike.
We each
right
have a strike
now.
Yes. Right now, yeah.
Yes. All right, Alex. On Kanye West's album Graduation, he has a full song named after one player, including the lyrics, here's another hit.
Oh my Ichiro? God.
No.
I don't respect Kanye, so no.
I know the answer here.
Say all it right. then.
It's Barry Bonds.
Yes, it is Barry Bonds.
Okay.
All right.
Yes.
Bryson Tiller plays on this slugger's name in Sorry Not Sorry in the line, pen blank, but she won't get a penny, no.
What? Is this like like an active player or something? Like, I'm confused.
This is a Hall of Famer.
A Hall of Famer?
Yes.
Oh my God, dude. I'm just going to take a wild guess. Hank Aaron.
It is not Hank Aaron. It is Griffey, Pen Griffey in this case. All right.
So I guess we both have two strikes.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm about to go for my third right now. Let's
okay.
go.
Oh, that's not the one I was looking for. Okay. Let me get the lyrics up for this one. Okay. This is from Eminem's song Campaign Speech. Swing for the fence is like blank, knock it into the Upper Peninsula.
Swing for the fence is like Sosa?
No. Mac, do you have an answer?
Actually, I have a second answer, but I'll
sure,
wait for Mac
go ahead.
To go, yeah.
I know that he's from Michigan.
Yes.
I don't know what year this song came out. That's the problem.
Yes.
So, I'm going to guess it's Miguel Cabrera.
Any other guesses, Alex?
That actually was my second guess.
Okay.
Was making
the
same.
The correct answer is Prince Fielder.
Oh.
Okay. All right. Sure. Well, okay. I've got three strikes now, but...
So that definitely went horribly, but I thought that was a fun trivia topic. Shout out to Cassie,
yeah.
Lots of love.
I mean, I feel like the only tough part with that one is that I don't know. I'm not as familiar with like those artists. I'll say that much. I know.
Is this not the only song I knew from everyone that you put in there was from Epic Rap Battles of History? I honestly thought you were going to make a joke on the Lance Armstrong versus Babe Ruth.
That was going to be the second one, but I didn't want to double dip with an artist.
You should have, because that was the only one I knew.
I probably should have.
To be fair, when you said the Jay-Z one, though, I was very tempted to just say Robinson Cano, just because I know that there's that connection. But...
He is Jackie Robinson in one of the songs. I forget which one, but there's a Jackie Robinson in there. You know, I have the Genius app, so you can, like, search insert player.
Uh-huh.
Like, I found one that it was, like, Alex Rodriguez, but it was a Spanish song, and I don't want to butcher the Spanish. So,
yeah, I know that because when I was... in middle school, one of our family friends gave us a CD. It's like baseball's greatest hits, and they have a song like Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. Dying Cub Fan's Last Request by Steve Goodman, which is a classic. There's a whole bunch of great
We
ones
Are Family
on
for the 90s or the 79.
Yeah, We Are Family. Yeah, it was. I forget the whole album. I'd have to look it up. I know one of them is about this guy Van Lingo Mungo, and it's just like all like the funny baseball names out there. So, yeah, but that was. I feel like that's a good segment though. That I'd like to try my hand at it again at some point. I'll tell you that much.
I was torn between doing music and doing like other things. So like I walk by Lindor truffles every day at work, like the chocolate. How many other players can you like find at a grocery store?
Yeah, of course.
Like Tim Salmon.
Salmon,
Mike Trout.
Yeah. Trout.
So
yeah, I mean
Julio's.
Well, right. I can't find those here in Virginia, but
I mean that sounds like a personal problem there, Splash. But
yeah. See, for those of you who don't know, my parents are both musicians, so I've been raised on listening to all sorts of music. Most of it, older stuff.
Well, hey, congratulations! So. You won the music trivia. So
yeah, exactly. Oh,
okay, I do have two alternate questions. One, name the only team mentioned in Fall Out Boy's cover of "We Didn't Start the Fire."
Oh, I do know this one. I just listened to it. Actually, I literally listened to it like last week.
No,
I don't. I want to say it was the Yankees. No, it was Cubs. It was the
Cubs.
Yes,
it is Cubs. Cubs.
Yeah, let's go. Right. It was Cubs win it all. I think was the lyrics.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
See, in the Billy Joel version, it's Brooklyn's got a winning team. I know.
And they also say California baseball.
California baseball.
Mickey Mantle.
Yeah.
I think
Mickey Mantle's also in that team.
Joe DiMaggio.
My best friend Nick is going to be very happy with me that I remember something from a Fall Out Boy song.
Good job, everybody.
Alrighty. All right, Matt, do you want to hit us with the moment to ourselves?
Yes. As we end every show, 60 seconds, give or take a few to talk about whatever the heck is on your mind. So who here wants to go first for their moment to themselves? It can be literally anything. All right, Alex, your time starts in 3, 2, 1, go.
So I've recently gotten back into MLB The Show, and do I regret it? Yeah, I kind of do, actually. Like, don't get me wrong, it's been fun. Played a couple games against Mac, now we're 1-1. But I think right now, like, if you're going to do anything, the biggest thing that happened this year was the sets system, where cards were released for certain sets or under core, which they work for every set. And at that point, once you got past, like, a certain set, each season had different sets that you could use. And if it was in a set that was already gone, then you could use it in online play. And it has been a big failure so far. Here's my opinion how to change it, right? If you're going to keep sets, get rid of having the tedious amount of grinding that you have. Here's what makes it a lot easier to actually get the cards that you're only going to be able to use for 2 months. Then make sure that the cards that you are getting, right? You're going to try and have don't just release the same 99 over and over and over again. Let's use some extra different players, right? Like, let's get a Jose Caballero in there. Let's get a 99 Edgar in the lineup every now and then. But give at the very most 3. And that is at the very most, and one of those better be a monthly awards player. So at that point, just make it so we're always changing up our teams, having fun with it, but also don't make us grind for everything. Because grinding for everything is going to be what kills the game.
Yeah, I'm going to second that, because this is the first time in a while that I have lost interest in MLB The Show.
This is the earliest I've ever lost like interest since like 2017.
And I'm slowly getting back into it, but like, it's like you said, the grinding this year was just it was a struggle, especially when you get the car and then it disappears in 2 weeks or something. Anyway, Splash, do you want to go next or shall I?
You can go. I'm still thinking.
All right. Give me a second. I'll get started in 3, 2, 1. So I just want to talk about a little bit about the weird Syracuse football game this week. They beat Pitt at Yankee Stadium 28-13, snapped a 5-game losing streak. So they're 5-5. They're 1 win away from going to another bowl game. But what was crazy is that They only had 17 passing yards. Carlos Del Rio Wilson, the backup quarterback, got hurt. Garrett Schrader, the starting quarterback, has a shoulder problem, can barely throw. So ACC running back of the week, co-running back of the week, is Dan Vellari, who is a tight end. He led the team in rushing, over 150 rushing yards, rushing touchdown. They occasionally put LaQuint Allen, a running back, in at quarterback. For the record, Vellari is also a former quarterback that happens to be a tight end now. So I just think it's quirky that a tight end that used to be a quarterback won running back of the week. And, you know, it's been pretty rough lately for the Syracuse football team, but maybe this at least gets us to a bowl game, question mark. I don't know. Finally, there's something to be excited about in Orange Land. All right, Splash, you're up. Right.
Sure.
All right.
Okay.
Your time starts in 3, 2, 1.
I'm low-key kind of excited for Thanksgiving. I'm going to make pizza rolls as an appetizer and not like Tostino's rolls. I make these little puff pastry rolls. So you have your puff pastry, you set that out, you lay that sheet down, you cover it with tomato sauce, marinara sauce, your favorite. You put pepperoni or whatever other toppings you want. Then you put cheese, and then you you roll. Or you cut the puff pastry into slices, and you stick the puff pastry onto a skewer. You like zigzag it back and forth so it looks like the Hermes staff thingy, like the doctor's thing. That thingy, right? So it's like a big snake on the skewer. You pop it in the air fryer. You pop it in the oven, and 10 minutes later, it comes out. It's great. So I'm gonna make that for Thanksgiving. I might get to see my dad that week, so that's cool. So Thanksgiving should be a fun time.
Yeah, and I'm personally, I mean, Thanksgiving I look forward to every year, but this year it sounds like my sister's coming to town, and it sounds like one of my older brothers is also coming to town, so I'm looking forward to it. Plus, my mom has been in Japan for the last almost a month now, so she's coming home on Friday, but yeah, I look forward to Thanksgiving. You know, any holiday that's celebrated by eating is one I'm going to enjoy. I'll tell you that much. Also, we don't really do turkey anymore. I'll tell you that much. But that's a story for another time.
Do you turducken?
You know, I think we may have done that once personally because I love duck.
Yes,
I think duck is amazing.
I can co-sign
and I love
that.
Chicken and I love turkey. So, but yeah, I think we're going with like roast pork this year. We do all sorts of things, but turkey is not necessarily my favorite type of meat, but it's still good. I mean, I just like anything with gravy on it personally, but
are you
anyways,
a white meat or dark meat guy?
Oh, dark meat.
Ooh, white meat. 100%.
Yeah, I mean, either honestly, but. But anyways, speaking of which, yeah, next week will be, I guess, our Thanksgiving type episode because it will be Thanksgiving week. So hope you all are getting ready to celebrate that. Thank you all for listening. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at LAR_baseball. Follow myself at Matthias_A_K. Follow Alex at the sports guy 242 and follow Splash at Mr. Splashman 19. But for everyone at Losses Above Replacement, thank you all for listening, and I hope to see you all real soon. Take care.